Good morning, I'm Wayne Zell. Thanks for coming to Controlled Exits Using ESOPs. With me is my co-presenter, Ted Lauer, who is a senior vice president at Access National Bank, and he's an expert in leveraged ESOPs using Small Business Association SBA loans. And we're going to focus on the topic generally of ESOPs today, employee stock ownership plans. How many of you are familiar with the idea of ESOPs, generally? Okay. How many are using ESOPs in your practices? Okay, good. Nobody. That's a good sign. That's why we are here. Okay, so we're gonna try to educate you on the use of ESOPs, how they're used, what they are beneficial for, what the ways in which they can be used. They can be used in a lot of different ways. We'll show you that a little bit. And why leveraged ESOPs are particularly attractive. I'm a partner here at Odin Feldman and Pittleman. A little bit about the firm. The firm is 60 lawyers, ranging in practice from business, trusts and estates, corporate, divorce, bankruptcy, intellectual property, and of course litigation. We have a strong litigation practice here. Firm's been around for about 42 years, and we are proud to be co-hosting this today with Access National Bank. We're trying to do some programs with them based on some common clients that we have as well as relationships that we've got. With me today is Ted Lauer. Ted, you want to give a 2 cents on Access National Bank and a little bit about you?
Sure. Access National Bank is headquartered here in Reston. Diane Holland, our branch manager in Reston, is with us today. It's a business-focused bank. And we opened in 1999. We've been fortunate. We have about 50 consecutive quarterly profits. So the way we manage to stay profitable is we know our customers well and we meet their needs. And our focus is in a couple different verticals. Medical lending is one. Medical practice lending is a good example. John Yaremchuk's with us today. He represents that team. He leads that team. We also have a focus on government contracting and professional services in general. So with that, I'll turn it back to Wayne.
Good. So this will be a brief introduction to the concept of ESOPs, how they work, some of the ins and outs of using ESOPs, and then also introducing you to the concept of leveraged ESOPs, using borrowing to leverage the ESOP. An ESOP is an employee stock ownership plan. It's a special incentive that was created all the way back in the 1970s, and really they've existed since the 1950s in reality, but they were codified in the 1970s as part of the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, ERISA. And therefore, it is a qualified plan for the benefit of the corporation's employees. It can't be for any non-employees. And as a qualified plan, it's subject to all the rigorous requirements that ERISA imposes, but there are tons of exceptions that apply only to ESOPs. In fact, it's the only qualified plan that is allowed to engage in borrowing. It's the only qualified plan that can borrow money. More importantly, it can borrow money from somebody who is associated with the company that's sponsoring the plan. So in an ESOP, you have an employer known as the sponsor, that creates a trust, an employee stock ownership trust. The trust is for the benefit of the employer's employees. And the trust has a trustee. The trustee is a fiduciary who's responsible for managing the assets of the ESOT or the ESOP for the benefit of the employees. The trustee, believe it or not, can be the same person who is the founder who is selling his shares to the trust. Now, a lot of my clients have utilized that scheme to keep control of the company, hence the title of our presentation today, Controlled Exits. But when you're dealing with leverage and you're dealing with banks, and particularly you're dealing with the SBA, the Small Business Administration, they like a little bit of independence. Independence separating the owner, who is the founder of the company, who may be selling his shares to the ESOP or her shares to the ESOP, and a separation between that and the trust. So they want independence. They want a third party who has experience in acting as a fiduciary over these types of trusts. The trust can actually purchase the stock of the founders. And that is a great business succession planning tool. But it's not the only use of ESOPs. ESOPs can be used in mergers and acquisitions. They can be used to divest a subsidiary to employees who want to continue owning and operating it. So as an example, let's say you've got a commercial brokerage subsidiary of a real estate management company, and they want to spin off the commercial brokerage. You can create a structure that allows you to spin off or divest the subsidiary using an ESOP for the benefit of the employees who are part of the commercial brokerage subsidiary and acquire the stock of the newly formed entity that's going to basically acquire the commercial brokerage entity. It doesn't have to be commercial brokerage. It could be manufacturing. It can be an internet company. It can be technology. It can be government contracting. It's used in all industries. So in a leveraged ESOP, we always have a lender. The lender may be a bank, Access National Bank. It may be a combination of the bank and others. There may be a syndicate. There may be a partnership. There could be senior debt, junior debt, or a combination called a unitranche. There's different ways of structuring this, myriad different ways of structuring the loans. But there is a lender in a leveraged ESOP. And the lender makes a loan. In this case, we're going to use a C corporation, a regular corporation, as the borrower, the one that wants to set up the ESOP. A C corporation is distinguished from an S corp. S corps also can use ESOPs, but they're subject to different rules. And they're subject to different constraints. So some of the things I'm about to say or about to highlight to you pertain to C corps. Most of our clients today are small business companies. Few of them are C corps. Many of them are S corps. But the C corp has some special advantages when it comes to an ESOP. The lender is going to lend the money to the corporation or to a newly formed ESOP for the benefit of the employees. It can do either, right, Ted?
Right.
So if it loans money to the ESOP, it's going to ask for collateral. It's going to ask for coverage. And the coverage is going to be in the form of the corporate parent's guarantee if it's lending the money to the ESOP directly. The corporation is going to be involved in this loan all the way through. If the corporation borrows the money, it is allowed under ERISA to re-lend the money to the ESOP, the trust. And it generally has to be on fair terms. But it doesn't have to be substantially identical terms to the loan terms that are being borrowed by the corporation. So often, it may have an extended term where there may be more favorable terms in terms of the loan from the corporation to the ESOP. You've got to be very careful, though, because you don't want to violate ERISA. And ERISA says, in general terms, every term of whatever transaction you engage in with this ESOP, with this trust, has to be fair. And it should be arm's length, or more favorable than arm's length, for the benefit of the employees. Well, there's the founder over there. He wants to sell his stock. So we're going to sell it to the ESOP. And the ESOP is going to become the owner of the stock. If it's a C corporation, there's no tax if the seller elects to reinvest the proceeds in qualified replacement property. This is under Code Section 1042 of the Internal Revenue Code. It's been around for a long time. People are just starting to take notice of it because there's so many businesses that are now coming to the point in their lives of needing to exit. The founders need to exit. Our baby boom generation is aging, and there are a lot of folks that haven't figured out the fact that they're not going to live forever, and at some point they're going to have to transition their business. So in transitioning their business, the ESOP is a great business succession strategy. And with a C corporation, not an S corp, with a C corporation, you can sell your stock to the ESOP, take the proceeds as long as you follow certain very rigorous criteria. You have to make an election. You have to notify the IRS of the fact that you bought this these qualified replacement securities, publicly traded stock basically, within 30 days of doing it. If you don't do it, you lose the right to the gain deferral. So if you follow the steps that are outlined in the Internal Revenue Code and in the regulations, you qualify for this benefit. The corporation can pay dividends to the ESOP. The C corporation can pay dividends to the ESOP and get a deduction for the contribution of the dividends to the ESOP. If you have dividends paid on the publicly traded stock that were reinvested by the founder, he does have to pay tax on the dividends. He doesn't escape income tax on that. Oftentimes, the bank or the lender is going to demand that the qualified replacement securities be used as collateral to support the loan. The corporation can pay dividends on the stock that's owned by the ESOP. And if the corporation's paying dividends on stock that's owned by the ESOP, it will get a deduction. Normally, corporations don't get deductions for the dividends that they pay to shareholders. This is one of those exceptions to the rule. So it's a valuable tool to enhance the tax benefits to the corporation to shift ownership of the company from the founder to the employees. And that was Congress's intent when they enacted this and codified it back in 1974. Now, a few items about the dividend. So the dividends are deductible if they're paid within a certain period of time and under certain circumstances. So let's say you've transferred stock from the owner to the ESOP, okay? So now the ESOP owns the founder's stock or a portion of the founder's stock. Well, one of the requirements to qualify for this tax-free rollover in a C corporation is that it has to have at least 30% of the stock of the company, measured by value and vote. It's a little bit more technical than that. So if it owns at least 30%, the founder, the guy who sold his stock to the ESOP, qualifies for this rollover treatment. It's a tax deferral. So if he buys these qualified replacement securities and then goes ahead and sells the qualified replacement securities later, he will pay tax at that time. And it'll be tax on the capital gain, the built-in gain that he rolled over from his old stock. So he gets a basis equal to what his old basis was. It rolls over into the new stock, and there's going to be a big long-term capital gain. So some people try to take these qualified replacement securities and to try to completely avoid gain. They may buy these 30 or 40-year variable corporate bonds that are very secure and borrow against the bonds, take the cash out, and then reinvest it in qualified publicly traded stock outside of the note. And when they do that, they can actually defer the gain indefinitely. If you die holding this qualified replacement security, it's stepped up to fair market value. So there's no tax. So death is the best planning technique of all. And so if the dividends are paid in cash, the company gets a deduction. If it's paid in cash directly to the ESOP and distributed out to the employees, or if it's paid to the employees directly in accordance with their deemed stock ownership under the ESOP, you get a deduction. It's also deductible if the money that's the dividend is reinvested in corporate securities, in the employer's securities. So if they take the dividends and reinvest it in the corporate stock, it's deductible. If you use it to repay an ESOP loan. So you've got leverage, right? You've borrowed money to help buy the stock. The payment of the dividend that is then used to repay the bank is deductible as long as it's used to repay the ESOP loan. So you have to be careful about dividends, though, because you could start playing games with the dividends. You could make them excessively high and unreasonable. And in that case, you risk two things. One is you risk a potential excise tax, but two, you risk disqualification of the ESOP under ERISA if it's too excessive. And believe it or not, there's a case called the Steel Balls case that stands for the proposition in the tax court that if you pay an overly excessive dividend to get the deduction and to get money out of the corporation into the ESOP, you could disqualify the ESOP. ESOP loans are required to get preferred terms. They can't be on lesser terms than the loan from the lender to the corporation, but they could have an extended payout period. They just need to be on preferred terms, maybe a lower interest rate than what the corporation is paying, different ways of structuring it. But the idea is that the principal and interest in a C corp and principal in an S corp is deductible. If you've got a C corporation, you can get this 1042 treatment. I said if you have an S corporation with an ESOP, you can't qualify for this rollover treatment. Well, the S corporation, if you have an S corporation that sells 100% of the stock of the founder to an ESOP, what happens? Anybody? Does anybody know? The ESOP now owns 100% of the stock of the S corporation. All of the earnings of the S corp would be tax exempt. Not a bad planning technique. If you want to get a founder out of a business, transferring 100% of the ownership of the company to the ESOP will allow 100% of the earnings of the S corp to be sheltered from income tax and grow income tax free. Of course, when it's distributed out, it's going to be ordinary income to the recipient. But if it's a long deferral period, if you've got a younger generation of employees in their 30s and 40s who are acquiring the ownership of the company, that's almost as good as a tax-free rollover under 1042. So if you sold 50% of your stock in the S corp to an ESOP, 50% of the earnings have to be allocated to the ESOP, and 50% of those earnings are not subject to tax. The permanent deferral of capital gains occurs if you die after you've sold your stock to the ESOP and you're holding qualified replacement securities at your death. So it's stepped up to fair market value. The basis gets stepped up so that the estate or the trust, if it sells the stock after death, there's no capital gain unless it grows post date of death. You can use an ESOP to buy another business. Let's say there's a target out there that you want to purchase. How do you do this? The lender can lend money to the C corp, which then reloans it to the ESOP. The ESOP uses that money from the loan to purchase stock from the corporation, newly issued stock. So what that does, it's going to cause a dilution to the existing shareholders because we're using newly issued stock to put into the ESOP, to get the money out of the ESOP back into the corporation's hands. The corporation then takes the cash and buys the assets or stock of the target. So it can be used in an asset acquisition, a stock acquisition, a merger, a divestiture. It's very, very flexible. Well, that's only assuming that you sold 100% of the company. But let's say I'm a founder and I own 70% of the stock. And let's say there's 30% in the ESOP already. Now I want to get some additional liquidity and buy this target company. So I'm going to issue another 20% in shares. I'm going to dilute my 70% pro rata, and the other 30% is going to be enhanced. So the existing shareholders outside of the ESOP will be diluted. Again, principal and interest deductible. You need collateral for these loans. Qualified replacement securities can serve as collateral, but the target's assets and business is maybe sufficient collateral for the bank here. S-corps, as I mentioned, compared to a C-corp, let's say the ESOP owns 50%. I was using that example earlier, and that no dividends or distributions are paid, and the annual income from the S-corp after bonuses, after expenses left over, is $1 million. Normally the owner would take it out in distributions or take out enough to pay his taxes and then put in back in enough to keep the company going. If the S corp is 50% owned by the ESOP, 50% of the income is subject to personal income tax at rates of at least 39.6%, potentially higher because of the net investment income tax. But only 50% is subject to tax. The other 50%, which has to be allocated to the ESOP is not taxed. So we've saved, it's really $350,000 at a 35% rate, highest rate in the corporation. There is a limitation on the amount that you can put into an ESOP in any year, and it's based on the payroll. First of all, the overall payroll of the corporation, 25% is the typical limitation. And there are other limitations that apply under ERISA. Like qualified plans, this has constraints, which may constrain the ability to fund the ESOP to repay the loan. So it'll give the ESOP an excuse to defer payment of the loan because it may not have enough money to do so. But there are other ways of getting money into the ESOP so that it can pay off the loan. What you have to be careful of when you structure this is to make sure that you're not just looking at the tax benefits to the seller or the founder at the front end. You've got to make absolutely sure that there's cash flow coming in from the business to fund the repayment of the debt on the ESOP. More differences. There are restrictions on the founder getting involved in the ESOP. You can't sell to the ESOP and then take advantage of the ESOP if you were a seller to the ESOP. There are very strict restrictions on that. Excise taxes that are prohibitive, potential disqualification of the ESOP. So just be aware of that. In a C corp, there's a lot more flexibility in structuring. And again, you can achieve the tax exemption because you can deduct the dividends that are payable from the C corp to the ESOP. So many S corps may consider converting into a C corp before they start using the ESOP. It depends. You have to look at the facts. There's no hard and fast black and white rule of thumb. Every year an ESOP has to undergo evaluation. So the cost of an ESOP is higher than just any plan of business succession outside of a qualified plan. An annual valuation has to be conducted, and there's annual compliance with ERISA. Some people estimate that those costs could be anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 a year. And to set up the ESOP, it may run as much as $80,000 to $100,000. So it's not an inconsequential thing to engage in an ESOP. But as I mentioned, controlled exits do exist. The ESOP can own a minority interest so that the founder can retain control over the corporation. And even if the founder decides that he wants to sell or she wants to sell 100% of his or her stock to the ESOP, he can and still keep control because he or she could be the trustee. In a leveraged ESOP, highly unlikely that the bank or the lender is going to let the seller also be the trustee because of the conflict of interest. But the idea is that there are ways of keeping control over the company even though you've sold your stock or you've sold some of it to the ESOP. Again, it's useful in a variety of different situations. The participants in the ESOP can be limited in a closely held company to vote only on certain actions, mergers and acquisitions, liquidations, sale of substantially all the business, or a recap of the business. Then the participants have to have a say in the vote. Otherwise, they have no say. Your team of advisors in an ESOP should be an attorney for the ESOP, which would be an ERISA lawyer specializing in ESOPs. It would be an attorney for the corporation, which is the role we usually serve. It would involve a valuation expert, an appraiser, somebody who has experience, who's not your CPA, who's not affiliated with your internal team of advisors, somebody independent. Usually an insurance professional, because insurance is an important component of helping to fund the obligations that may be in an ESOP. Let me give you an example. If somebody leaves the company and they have a participating share of an ESOP, they have a put right to force their shares to be sold back to the company or to the ESOP. They have the ability to get liquid. If the ESOP doesn't have enough cash to do that, what do you do? That's where insurance can come into play. Using life insurance, corporate-owned life insurance, inside the company that builds up cash surrender value, which can then be used to contribute to the ESOP, get a deduction, and fund that ESOP repurchase obligation. One of the most important components of doing ESOP planning is not just the setup. It's figuring out the employee census, doing actuarial analysis of the ages of the employees and the likelihood that these employees will be around for a period of time, and at what time are you expecting them to retire or resign or leave the company. So an ESOP really is, I think, most beneficial where you have a clear idea of who your employees are and what their ages are and how long they've been with the company, but how long they will be with the company. And so you do an actuarial analysis, which then comes up with a valuation spreadsheet that shows when you're going to need to repurchase their shares. It may not be 100% accurate, but it's more accurate than just sitting down and saying, well, he may be here 5 years and he may be here 6 years, and let's figure out what the company's going to be worth in the future, just using a back of the envelope calculation. It involves a valuation firm, and it may involve an actuary. So again, the costs of using these people can be very high. And so in creating an ESOP, the downside, in my opinion, is the cost, the annual cost and the planning that goes into this and the compliance. They get repurchased and put back into the pool. You can actually distribute cash and reallocate the shares across the ESOP pool. Or you can repurchase, or you can give them shares. They can walk away with shares. In an S-Corp, they can walk away with a share. But if they walk away with a share, they have that put right, so they can put it back, meaning that they sell it back. So if they sell it back, it goes back into the pool. So we've seen companies as small as $5 million in revenue doing this. I did one for a company that had $25 million in revenue. We did one for a company last year that was about $60 million. But I think when you get down into the $5 million in revenue range, that's probably as low as you want to go. And it also has to have an employee base to justify doing this. If you only have two or three or four or five employees, it doesn't make any sense. But if you have more than 15 or 20 employees, then it becomes logical to consider this. You have to figure out the cost to you, again, using this estimate of, you know, what I think the annual costs are and the cost of setup are. You have to figure out whether or not it's worth it for you. But it is a great exit strategy, and it's a convenient way, and it's very tax incentivized. So you have to sort of balance the benefits against the detriments. And we would work with you.
We did one for a company with $3.5 to $4 million in revenue, and it seemed to work well. They had over $1 million in EBITDA, though. They had very nice margins, and it's a professional service firm, so substantial payroll. Payroll was over $1 million. That is getting to the lower end, but it worked very well for them.